It's the art of reading character in faces, physiognomy. During the 1800s, physiognomy was all the rage, from identifying criminals to deciding presidential greatness. We're exploring why we put so much stock in first impressions this hour, what a face can tell us. Alexander Todorov is a psychology professor at Princeton University, where he's also affiliated with the Princeton Neuroscience Institute and the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. His new book is Face Value: The Irresistible Influence of First Impressions. Alexander, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think it's fair to say that we human beings are really complex, and when we meet a brand new person for the very first time, it sounds like we effectively size them up immediately and make this split-second judgment on this person. What is it behind first impressions? What's the significance here?
Well, in fact, you're right. We make these judgments incredibly rapidly from incredibly little information. So we have done many experimental studies where you can flash a face of a stranger that you've never seen before, and you need less than one-tenth of a second presentation, and this time provides sufficient information for people to make up their minds. In fact, if you give them additional time, the only effect is that it increases the confidence in their judgments. So it's something that is very efficient. It also matters in real life. You mentioned in your introduction how physiognomy was a really big deal and kind of got hold of the popular imagination in the 18th, 19th century, early 20th century. And it was consequential, but it hasn't disappeared from our life. There are many studies that these sorts of impressions predict all kinds of outcomes that we care about, from electoral success of politicians, with politicians looking more competent, being more likely to be elected, sentencing decisions with people who happen to look untrustworthy getting harsher sentences for the same crime than the peers who don't have the same kind of look, economic transactions, and so on and so on.
Well, break down physiognomy for us here, because you go back to it throughout the book. You take us into its history, and so that we're all on the same page here, explain to us what this exactly is.
Mm-hmm. Well, so physiognomy now is considered, it's a pseudoscience, and it's the idea that one's face is a window to their character, or in the past, window to their soul, that in a sense it's a really mirror of what you are as a person. And it has a very, very long history. I mean, the first preserved documents date back to Aristotle's time, and at the time was kind of a very crude and fanciful, in a sense. It was mainly based on comparisons between human physiognomy and animal physiognomy. So we'll have things like, if you kind of your face looks like a cow, perhaps you have the characteristics, the character of a cow, whatever that means. So there wasn't much in terms of a serious thinking at the time. And these ideas were really revived in 16th and 17th century, but became extremely popular at the end of 18th century after Johann Caspar Lavater, a Swiss pastor, wrote this four-volume work, Essays on Physiognomy. And then there's all of this ways to read the character according to Lavater, and in fact, his ambition was to make physiognomy as a science, but there's not much science in his writings. But nevertheless, it was extremely popular in Europe. It had, you know, it had about 150 editions within the next 100 years. When he passed away, the Gentleman magazine publication in London wrote in his obituary, essentially compared Lavater's books to the necessity of the Bible itself.
Wow, that's quite that's quite the statement there. Has physiognomy been discredited in the scientific world since then?
Yes and no, but I think there's actually an interesting modern revival of physiognomy. In early 20th century, physiognomists no longer called themselves physiognomists. They called themselves character analysts, and they worked for various businesses, essentially in employee selection. I mean, if you, this is the time of the so-called scientific management and people trying to find more efficient practices. So there were lots of so-called character analysts trying to get into the business. But then this is the time when the new science of psychology is founded, and psychologists were very skeptical about the claims of the character analysts. So they started testing, doing lots of tests whether, in fact, physiognomic judgments are accurate. A person who looks honest, are they actually honest, or a person who looks dishonest? And there wasn't much evidence that they found. The one thing that they found is that people agree in their impressions, and this is what kind of is the basis of the modern science of first impressions, trying to understand what is it that people agree on. And in the last 10, 15 years, surprisingly, there has been a revival. There have been many scientific papers showing that presumably we are better than chance guessing things like sexual orientation, political orientation, and so on. I actually have 4 chapters in the book on the accuracy question, and I think that a lot of the claims are overstated. But it's actually even worse than this, the scientific papers, because people don't make extreme claims. But there was a recent technology startup doing facial profiling, essentially what physiognomists were doing, but using machine learning methods, mm-hmm. and trying to sell it to governments and offices like Homeland Security and private businesses. And there's also a few computer science papers with similar kinds of conclusions, and there are lots of deep issues underlying this kind of work.
We're exploring what the face can tell us this hour, the power of first impressions, with Alexander Todorov. He's a psychology professor at Princeton University, and his new book is Face Value, The Irresistible Influence of First Impressions. You can join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. Can you remember a time you had a positive or negative first impression of a person just by looking at their face? How did that impact the way you thought about that person down the road? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Alexander, we've talked now about the history here. What about the face, though? Let's talk about faces, the focal point of what this discussion is about. Why are faces so powerful in having these sequences of events that go on, trigger things in our brain, and have implications all across our life?
Well, I mean, faces are one of the most important stimuli in our life. Newborns, born with readiness to perceive faces, their attention is attracted to faces. And within the first, there's lots of fascinating studies with newborns with virtually no visual experience, and they prefer to look at faces or to track face-like stimuli than equally complex stimuli. I have a chapter dedicated entirely on this development. And in the first few months of our life, the stimuli that we are most frequently exposed to faces, I mean, there are interesting studies. You can put a spy camera on infants and record everything they see in their looking time, and about 25% of their waking time they look at faces. And this intensive experience with faces develops into a highly, highly complex network in the brain, which is exclusively dedicated to the processing of faces. And right now, this is probably the best understood system in the brain for processing of high-level visual stimuli like faces. We're not talking about simple visual properties like luminance, contrast. We're talking about meaningful social categories. So faces are very important. I mean, it's not just you can think of whenever we communicate with other people, we can read their emotional states, mental states, and there's no other stimulus that attracts our attention so rapidly.
So this idea that we might judge someone's face as trustworthy or more caring or more competent, it means that at some point we developed a shared set of these physical characteristics that we fall back on to describe these personality traits. How did that all come to be?
Well, it's an interesting question. There are many multiple contributions to what goes into these impressions. We actually are able now to build mathematical models that visualize specific kinds of impressions, and the book is richly illustrated that just show different kinds of models. So you mentioned trustworthiness, which is a very, very important impression and summarizes a lot of our first impressions when we meet a new person. And when you visualize what goes into these first impressions, there are different things that influence our impressions. The first one is emotional expressions. Faces, and they needn't be explicit, exaggerated emotional expressions. People who look happy, and that can vary within the same person in different images on different days, in different situations, tend to be perceived as more trustworthy. People who look kind of disgruntled or angry tend to be perceived untrustworthy. So in a sense, this inference could be accurate at the moment of the situation here and now, what the intentions of this person are, but it doesn't mean that they're accurate in terms of what the character of the person is. Another input is femininity, masculinity, and that goes with the gender stereotypes. We tend to trust feminine faces, and we tend to trust masculine faces. And there are, of course, cultural influences that would depend on a specific culture. We tend to like and trust typical faces and distrust atypical faces. But what we consider typical is very much determined by our life exposure to different kinds of faces. A person who grows up in Asian culture will have a different notion of what is a typical face than a person growing up in a Caucasian culture. They're also completely idiosyncratic things that are specific to each one of you. We tend to trust people who resemble people whom we already trust, even if we are not aware of the physical similarity. And the other way around for people who resemble those who we distrust.
So our environment plays a role into face stereotypes that we develop?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in fact, this happens very early on. I mean, in the first, if you test infants, 3-month-old infants, and there's different, the way you test infants, usually the best you can do is look at their looking time or other behavioral measures. And if you show them two stimuli and they tend to look longer at one, that's an indication they have some kind of a preference. So there's different paradigms to test infants. So if you look at 3-month-old infants, in fact, they're equally good at discriminating faces from their own race, and I'll qualify this, and faces from other races. By 9 months, they're actually very good at discriminating faces from their own race, but not so much, but they kind of lose the ability to discriminate faces from other races. And there's a term in developmental psychology, it's called perceptual narrowing, because you kind of tune into what is relevant in your specific environment. And I wanted to qualify race because it's not something about race per se. It's about your visual exposure. So you take Korean children adopted by French families, and they show the opposite. They have problems with Korean faces, and they're better with French faces. So it's not really anything about it's a very broadly tuned ability to attend to faces, but then it becomes specifically tuned as a function of your experience with faces.
We're understanding why we humans pay so much attention to faces and what our judgments tell us. We're taking a tour of the human face this hour with Princeton University psychology professor Alexander Todorov. His new book is Face Value, The Irresistible Influence of First Impressions. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Can you remember a time you had a positive or negative first impression of a person just by looking at their face? How did that influence how you thought about the person down the road? What questions do you have about faces? Join in 800-642-1234 or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll be back after a short break here on the Ideas Network. Studies have shown that facial bias affects who we vote for, who we date, who we hire, who we prosecute and convict. The list goes on and on. What people see in a face can have far-reaching implications. Good morning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for the Joy Cardine Show. We're learning about why faces matter deeply, and influence everything with the lead researcher on first impressions, Princeton University psychologist Alexander Todorov. His new book is Face Value, The Irresistible Influence of First Impressions. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about first impressions? Have you been judged, or have you judged someone based on their face? Tell your story, 800-642-1234, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Alexander, what about first impressions in a job interview, first impressions in the workplace, and even the impression people see from a person's picture on LinkedIn, on their profile, of their resume, and their work life? What about how we look in the workplace?
Absolutely. I mean, it's not different than any other situation. I mean, the moment you see an image of a person, you're already ready to form an impression. It's impressions are more like perceptions rather than like thinking. I mean, we don't think about what this person is like. We already kind of think that we know what the person is like. And you mentioned interviews. Interviews are very, very interesting because we put so much faith in interviews. But unstructured interviews, and notice that you have so much more information than a single image, are fairly close to being completely useless predictors of performance, of future success.
Wait, you said an interview is pretty useless to predict future success.
Exactly. I mean, we have known this in psychology for now maybe 40 or 50 years. So if you look at, there's been dozens and dozens of studies in the past, and if you simply look at the correlation, that is how much you can predict from your impression from an interview and how the person will do down the line, the correlation is really tiny. It's like 0.10, which, you know, you can explain about 3% of the future performance of the person. This is extremely, extremely weak predictor of performance. And so I'm talking about unstructured interviews, which is different than when, for example, you can have diagnostic questions or things that kind of are revealing about the skills or abilities of potential employee. Unstructured interviews are just about our impressions. We put too much faith, but you have very little information. So shy people naturally wouldn't do very well in anxiety-provoking situation. Extroverted people will do better, but that doesn't mean that they will be better for whatever the job is. And if you look there, for letters of reference are much more diagnostic. Again, they're not hugely predictive, but they're much better than interviews simply because they summarize longer samples of observations. So interviews, we always put a lot of faith in our first impressions, but an interview is just an interview. I mean, when you with your friends, you have lots of occasions to interact, and you have a pretty good idea what they're like. But that's not the case when you're meeting a person for the first time, because this interaction is affected by many, many different things. Maybe the person didn't have a good night's sleep. Maybe you're in a bad mood. Maybe you just had an argument with your spouse before the interview. All of these things affect what's happening here and now, and that is true for every specific situation.
Let's take a call now at 800-642-1234. Kathy is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I'm interested in the poor World War I veterans who came back so facially disfigured. And I'm wondering, what happens in our brain that makes it so difficult, you know, to look at someone who's disfigured? Is it like a synapse thing or?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, I think that this really has to do with the fact that we kind of like to, we like and trust typical faces, and things that are really strongly deviating from what we perceive as normal attract our attention, and we generally tend to attribute negative characteristics to these people, and it's a kind of a shame, but it's very hard to overcome this bias. And you see this, in fact, even if you just take a normal set of faces without disfigurement, and if you have people rate the face on different characteristics, the more distinctive the face, more atypical, the more likely it's also going to be perceived as being looking like a criminal and so on. So it is right that this is very hard to overcome these kinds of biases.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much for calling in with that question. Alexander, you've been working in this field of research for quite a while now. What drew you to it in the first place? And by the way, you know, I flipped to the back cover to see right away what you look like, what your face was.
Well, but it's all misleading, you know that. It is true. I've worked for quite some time. In fact, my dissertation had a face component, and this is the first time I was interested in faces. Partly because it turns out that if you learn some kind of evaluative fact about a person, you learn that somebody did something bad or something good, the moment you have a face image, you might not remember the specifics of this fact, but if the moment you see the face, the same image again, you will have a bad or good feeling depending on what you've learned about the person. So face is a really potent stimuli for organizing all of the kinds of information we have about other people. Pretty much everybody has the experience that remembering names is very difficult, but that is not the case for remembering faces, especially if you've seen them more than once. But what really made me interested in studying first impressions, when I started here in Princeton as a young assistant professor, and that was more than 15 years ago, we conducted a study in which we presented participants with pictures of politicians who were running for the U.S. Senate. Mm. And we did this about 100 races across three different election cycles. And I honestly don't remember why we decided to do that. But the finding was very surprising. It turns out that if you aggregate the judgment of about not more than 40 participants, you don't need a very large sample, and the participants' judgment is simply who appears more competent. And we asked about many other different things, but this was the judgment that was really important. So if you aggregate these judgments, essentially looking at whether the majority of these 40 or so people say that one of the politicians is more competent, we could predict about 70% of the election outcomes. So this is entirely based on first impressions. The participants didn't even know that they were judging politicians. We asked them whether they would recognize them, and if they recognize a politician, we don't use their judgment. And there have been dozens of international replications. In some cases, you have Swiss children predicting the success of French politicians. Obviously, with children, you have to ask them differently, but in this particular study, the researchers told them to imagine that they would describe the Odysseus trip to Ithaca, and then they told the kids, imagine now that you have this difficult voyage and you have to pick up the captain of your ship, and here are the two captains. Who would you pick? But this was the finding that was really surprising, that the effects were so strong. And then I was interested, what goes into these first impressions and how quickly we form these impressions? And the result is more than 10 years of work in this book.
Yeah, and are you researchers at Princeton still carrying out these experiments, if you will, on elections? And what about the last presidential election?
Curious. Well, it's interesting. First of all, we never predict a single election. Because the way we would do it is we would take, let's say, 150 gubernatorial races over the last 12 years or so, or we'll take, 100 Senate races. You have about, I think, 36 Senate races every 2 years, but we always exclude politicians who are highly familiar. For example, in the initial studies, we'll exclude John Kerry, we'll exclude Hillary Clinton, and then we look, how many of these we predict specifically. And so for single elections, it's very hard. I mean, if you're really going to predict a single election, and very few predicted this one, you would rely on different information. Mm. The second thing is that information where they're kind of knowledge saturated, all of the bets are kind of off, because once you have a knowledge about the person, the rules of the game completely change. And in the last elections, the voters were so completely polarized that it's very difficult to draw any conclusions about how appearance could have affected. There's just way too many things that play out in every single election.
Oh, so there were a lot of other influences that would have perhaps corrupted the work you were trying to do. I mean, there were just too many other variables going on.
Absolutely. I mean, once you have a knowledge, and in fact, even your ideological orientation to begin with will color your judgments the moment you know what the ideological orientation of the politicians. You're more likely to be favorable to politicians who match your ideological orientation than others. And whenever the candidates are so different and the opinion is so polarized, things get completely different.
As you page through your book, obviously you notice that you're using all Caucasian faces on this research. Why do you stick with Caucasian faces?
To a large extent, most of the studies, you're right, we stick to Caucasian faces, partly because we didn't want to include stereotypes, essentially because these are first impressions, and we wanted to find what is the input to these impressions outside of the stereotypes. And stereotypes are incredibly powerful in shaping our perceptions and decisions. And this actually is also true for gender, not just only for a race. But the moment you categorize a face as belonging to a particular ethnicity, that activates a number of stereotypes that most people are aware of these stereotypes if they've grown up in the particular culture. And again, that changes, could change quite a bit the judgment. So we're really kind of trying to stay clear from using different faces, different ethnicities, simply because we wanted to look with, if you don't have kind of explicit stereotype, what are the stereotypes of first impressions? Because at the end of the day, first impressions are visual stereotypes.
Yeah, and how have different races, different ethnicities dealt with these first impressions? Because it's baggage they have to carry, for some races have to carry with them wherever they go.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a very hard question, and it's hard to know what it is from a perspective of a person who belongs to ethnicity that has been traditionally discriminated, for example. And yes, stereotypes and biases are things that could be very subtle. I mean, it's not that most people want to do the right thing. Most people are not explicit racist or explicit sexist. But when the performance is ambiguous, what you observe in the world is ambiguous, and that is most of the time, these biases can shape you or push you in one or another direction. There's one example in the book. It was a research by economists. In the 80s, if you look at the large symphony orchestra around the world, there were very, very few musicians who were women. Most of the musicians were men. Part of this was totally explicit prejudice, like the Vienna Philharmonic was notorious for its explicit exclusion of women. And then in the 80s, suddenly you have influx of women. And you might be wondering, well, what happened? Perhaps people finally got to their senses and they were much more sensible and they were not prejudiced. But this is not the major change. The major change is orchestra introduced blind auditions, which means that the candidate is performing behind a curtain on a stage, and so the committee cannot see them. The only thing they can do is to hear the musician, and now you kind of prevent the prejudice coloring your judgment, and suddenly you have much more women. So it's not about that they were less capable of performing, and it wasn't so much about this, and most likely this subtle implicit biases that shaped these decisions. It was just the role of the biases that excluded women.
So we could learn a lot from orchestral interviews.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, it would be very hard to implement in many areas of life. I mean, you can make a similar argument for legal trials, for example, but that would be impossible.
We're talking right now with Princeton University psychologist Alexander Todorov this hour. We're talking about the power of snap judgments when looking at a face. And his new book is Face Value, The Irresistible Influence of First Impressions. We're taking your thoughts on this as well at 800-642-1234. What role has your face had in your life? Have you judged someone, made a decision about someone based on that first impression? We're discussing first impressions, 800-642-1234, what they mean. You can post your thoughts, your questions on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Alexander, it's one thing to be aware that we're making these impossibly fast decisions based only on a face, but it's another thing altogether to actually change our behavior. Can that actually be done? Can we change our behavior?
Yes, in principle. Again, it depends very much on the situation. For example, if you are interviewing employees, future potential employees, you can structure the decision process so that appearance information comes at the end or doesn't come at all into your decision. For example, we always interview graduate students, and I always hated this process because, as I mentioned earlier, psychologists have known that for the last 40 years, these interviews are completely useless as predictors of future success. So you can make up your mind before you meet the person, and you have all of the relevant information. You have their past performance, you have their letters of reference, you have their research statement. There's enough evidence that is way, way better than the impression you will get from the interviews. The problem is that subjectively, especially if you're not aware of that, we put much more weight in our impression from the interview than in this other evidence that is much better and more diagnostic for what the person will do in the future.
But is it humanly possible to withhold judgment in a face-to-face meeting with somebody?
Unfortunately, no. I'm skeptical that this would happen. And yes, it's hard to avoid these biases. Again, there's a caveat here. If you have the opportunity to learn more about the person, you're in a situation where you can interact and you can witness their competence and abilities, we will change our minds. So the problem is when these first impressions kind of shape your decision never to interact with the person, or if you use them as your decisional shortcut, whether to give a chance to this person or not. We do change our minds, and this is not very difficult. The question is whether we ever get to the situation where we have the opportunity to observe the person in the right circumstances and to change our minds.
What do we know about first impressions in the courtroom? The alleged sitting there looking up to the bench at the judge. We have a jury. We have attorneys, prosecutors, defense attorneys. What happens in the courtroom with the face?
It's, again, there's lots of experimental studies in which it's easy to bias jury decisions, but they're kind of experimental mock studies where you don't have real jurors, and there's a few real-world studies. Obviously, these studies are much more difficult to conduct and control because in the world there's so many other things that can affect what you observe. But the few studies that are there suggest that, in fact, these sorts of impressions can affect the potential outcome. There was a study in small civil courts in Boston in the past where people simply will, and this is a study where it's just a single judge and there are no jurors, so it's relatively easy to investigate. And in this particular case, facial stereotypes were predictive of the final outcome. There was a recent, much more disturbing study, more disturbing outcome, in which they looked at all prisoners in Florida who were either sentenced to death or sentenced to parole, life sentence without parole, for the same kind of a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference between these two groups of people was the people who were sentenced to death looked more untrustworthy. This is after controlling for attractiveness, controlling for race, controlling for gender. Well, I think that almost all of these people were men. And controlling for all of this, so that suggests that, in fact, that might have an effect. Obviously, it's very hard to figure out how does this play out in the real world. I mean, to get back to the political election studies, the fact that you find out that these simple, naive judgments predict political electoral success doesn't mean that this is what most voters are doing. In fact, at least in this domain, there have been a lot of follow-up studies by political scientists, and they suggest that there's only a particular category of voters who are influenced by appearance, and these are the people who are not really invested. They know next to nothing about politics. So the less you know about politics, the stronger the effect of appearance on your decision.
We're talking with Alexander Todorov this hour about the power of snap judgments when looking at a face. Do you dread hearing someone asking for a professional photo, perhaps? Do you struggle to find the right photo for your LinkedIn site or that you post to Facebook? There is a reason behind your trepidation. Different pictures of the same person produce radically different impressions, and we're learning about these impressions this hour. His new book is Face Value, The Irresistible Influence of First Impressions. Your thoughts, we're taking them as well. 800-642-1234. What role has your face had in your life? Have you judged someone, made a decision about someone based on that first impression? Did you realize you were doing it? We're discussing first impressions, 800-642-1234. Getting your thoughts as well on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll be back after this short break here on the Ideas Network. Here's the question posed on Alexander Todorov's Big Think website. Can you spot a liar or a lover by how they look? We're talking about the power of first impressions this hour. Todorov is a psychology professor at Princeton University, where he's affiliated with the Princeton Neuroscience Institute and the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. His new book is titled Face Value. Getting your questions about the human face at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. So, Alexander, I want to ask that question back to you. Can you spot a liar or a lover by how they look?
Well, I think that the title of the video is a bit misleading.
Okay. Fair enough.
There's quite a bit of work in psychology and lie detection, and the findings are not very good. I mean, including different tests. It's just if you ask people to detect a lie, and you can instruct people to either lie or not, which arguably it's a fairly artificial situation, people are barely above chance level of recognition. Mm. So it is a kind of a... but it's a very, very long history of research on deception in psychology.
Let's now go to Grace in Milwaukee. Hi, Grace. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So I was listening to the interview, and apparently, okay, so have you done any studies involving intra-racial discrimination just based on, the superficial look of a person? Like within, say, for example, I'm African-American. Within African-Americans, I know that colorism in a lot of minority groups is really, really big. It is in African-American communities and also others. But have you done any studies? Are there studies out there that perhaps you can comment on them, the results of which maybe you can comment on it? And speaking about the LinkedIn, yes, I use a picture of me that is probably 10 or 15 years younger. Don't shame me. And only because I don't want to be a victim of discrimination, age mm-hmm. discrimination, that is. All right, carry forth. Thank you.
Thanks, Grace, so much.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're right. There's lots of, as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of discrimination. There's actually incredible rich amount of studies in social psychology on stereotypes and prejudice and different kinds of discrimination. It's one of the most developed area in social psychology, or there are lots of people who work in this area. And in fact, there are many, many biases. And there are studies, for example, if you look even within minorities, if you look at African-American minorities, there are lots of biases documented there based on skin tone. So African Americans who happen to have a lighter skin tone might are less likely to be discriminated than African Americans who have a darker skin tone. There's similar biases with more Afrocentric features. African Americans who have more Afrocentric features, they're more likely to be discriminated. So this is a, it's really, really well documented.
Well, Grace, thank you so much for your call. Let's now go to Anne in Monona. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I don't know whether this interests you or whether you've ever done studies on it, but my first impressions of people so often come from their voices. And when I actually meet them or see them, say, on television, they're almost always, they look completely different from the mental image I've formed of them. And it's so hard for me to correlate those two. You know, I still think of them for a long time as I thought of them in my mind, you know, rather than as they are, as they look.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, I've done some studies. It's not my area of expertise, but I've collaborated with people from the University of Glasgow who study voices. And people form impressions from voices just the way they form impressions from faces. And the same way we kind of like more typical voices and we tend to dislike atypical voices. We did a study, it was done in Scotland, where you, people, listeners hear simple hello. And from this simple word, it's enough for them to draw inferences whether the person is trustworthy, whether it's competent, attractive, and so on. The important thing is that they agree with each other, just the way they agree with faces. So voices are very strong, and voices are also very distinctive. For some reason, there's much more studies on face perception than voice perception, but it's changing in the field. And typically in the area of first impressions, you observe extremely, extremely similar effects to what we observe with faces.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for calling in. Alexander, what research still needs to be done here on the human face? What do we still have to learn?
Oh, there's a lot to be learned by studying the faces. It's not accidental that there's so much work on face perception. I mean, there's very big general questions. For example, one of the big questions in understanding the brain is how the brain is organized. So let me create two caricatures, two views. But one extreme view is that it's kind of organized in discrete modules that handle specific kinds of information. And another view is that, no, it's some kind of a general system that is capable of doing any kind of task, like a computer system. And faces have been extremely important in this debate because we have regions in the brain which seem to be specialized, dedicated exclusively to the processing of faces. And this is not just work with humans. There's a lot of studies, neurophysiology studies with monkeys. We have people with face blindness or prosopagnosia, which is specific impairment in which they can, they're perfectly capable of recognizing all kinds of objects except for faces. And it's a fascinating phenomena, and it gives us a lot of information about how the brain is developed, how the brain is organized, and generates a lot of novel questions and interesting questions. And this is a continuing debate in the field of cognitive neuroscience.
Well, as we wrap up here in the next 30 seconds or so, can you offer any tips to help us nail our first impressions in the future? What advice would you give us?
Well, it would very much depend on the situation, and you're right, you mentioned earlier that people should be careful when what kinds of images they post on themselves, and presumably your image on LinkedIn would be different than the images you are posting on online dating websites or the images that images that are specifically for your friends on Facebook, because these are different audiences, and people just read too much out of the image. So, in fact, you would be careful. And again, it would very much depend on the situation. You will dress up one way for a party with friends and a different for a formal job interview. But again, if the job interview is in some kind of a silicon high-tech company, maybe you shouldn't be too formal because it kind of will stick out.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Alexander Todorov, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Alexander Todorov is the author of the new book, Face Value, The Irresistible Influence of First Impressions. He's a psychology professor at Princeton University. And now we're going to spend the last few minutes recognizing a special day here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Our own talk show host, Larry Mueller, will be inducted into the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association Hall of Fame today. The award honors Mueller's 50-year career on WPR. You can hear him every day here on the Ideas Network from 11 to 12:30. I caught up with Larry to hear his story as WPR's longest-serving host and how he found himself behind the mic in 1967.
I was a graduate student in the Department of Agricultural Journalism. Actually, I was an undergraduate student, and I took a course in radio from Maury White in my senior year. Maury was going to Colorado for the summer and needed someone to do his half-hour radio show. So he said, how would you like to go on for a master's degree? and then you could do my radio show for me and get your master's. And I didn't have any job prospects. So I said, well, that sounds interesting. Sounds like a good idea.
A decade goes by and you have this new program, Wisconsin Here and Now. And you started taking callers in 1978. Do you remember that first call?
I had two veterinarians on, and I'm wondering if anybody's going to call. Grace Pearson, who subsequently, later, she called many, many times. She was from Stevens Point, Wisconsin. And I'm waiting for that question, and she says, how do I tell if my cat is a male or a female? And the vet said, well, you pick up its tail. That was the first question. And we're kind of off and running from there and just having a lot of fun, but I think also getting a lot of pretty good information out to people.
You've been described as the friendly host who has kitchen table conversations. Do you see yourself that way?
Yeah, I think so. I'm more or less off air the way I am on the air. I'm curious about things. I don't think I'm pretentious at all. I, you know, was raised to be respectful to people, and I think I'm respectful to my audience.
Did you receive some good advice along the way that's stuck with you?
Be prepared. Once, a long time ago, I was interviewing a person who was supposed to talk about how to deal with stress. And so I had read some things on it beforehand, and she was quite good beforehand. We got her in the studio, and then I asked her the first question, and she kind of stressed out herself, and her mouth opened, and nothing came out. So I said, you know, before you answer that question, let me take a crack at that. And so I answered my own question, and then I asked her another one, and I actually answered that one. And then somebody had already called and asked a question, and I sort of answered their question. And at that point, something came, you know, something finally clicked with her, and, you know, then she was fine the rest of the show, and I got a lot of mail on it, and the gist of every one of the comments was, why don't you let your guests do the talking? Why are you asking, answering those questions?
You can't win, Larry.
But it's, you know, it does go to being prepared.
How have you given back and left your mark in broadcasting?
I've been able to pass on a lot of great information, not things that I necessarily knew, but what my guests knew to people. And I think my goal has always been to have fun and have our listeners have fun, but also have them learn something. And I think of anything I've done, I think I've been able to pass on a fair amount of learning.
And our Larry Mueller had a whole lot more to say about attending a one-room schoolhouse, hosting Santa and his elves on his show, and where he learned so much about gardening. You can find our extended interview at WPR.org. This hour of the Joy Cardine Show was produced by Chris Molina and Brianne Chasso. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer Kent, in for Joy Cardine. Coming up tomorrow at this time, it's the Week in Review. Our guests will discuss and debate the top issues of the week. That's coming up tomorrow after 8 here on the Ideas Network.